This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. I love the words of Psalm 8. Oh, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. When I behold your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? It's really great. Well, the truth is the Bible says that the heavens are telling the glory of God over and against the claims of naturalists and evolutionists who leave God completely out when they try to explain his wonderful creation. But of course, God's glory in his creation can't be hidden. We're going to talk about it today with Paul Gould. He teaches philosophy and apologetics at Oklahoma Baptist University. He's the founder and president of the Two Tasks Institute and also the editor and or author of several books, including the one we'll be discussing today. It's called The Story of the Cosmos, How the Heavens Declare the Glory of God. Paul, it's great to have you with us today. How are you?
Great, Janet. Thanks for having me. Doing really well.
Oh, that's great. It's great to have you with us. What do you think about all these modern scientists or naturalists or atheists who can look at God's creation and leave the Creator completely out? They just omit him from the entire picture.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting, right? Because if you go back even 500 years, you know, and read some of the literature, we're looking up at the same night sky, and people are very naturally moved from the awe and the beauty and the wonder of the world that they see to, you know, to proclaim and worship the God who created it. Whereas if you fast forward to today, you know, people look up at that same night sky and they look at the universe and they don't see any meaning. They don't see any purpose. They just think we exist on an insignificant planet in the middle of a, you know, mediocre galaxy, and there's no meaning to it all. So yeah, it's really interesting, but I think it's driven by some of the philosophies that undergird contemporary, you know, much of contemporary science as well.
That's right. Well, knowing the field of philosophy as you do, what would you say are some of the philosophies that are destroying the ability of a lot of people to look up at the heavens and see the glory of God? What are some of the most pervasive philosophies that are leading man in the wrong direction?
Yeah, I think there's three that come to mind. The first is general theory of knowledge called scientism that's out there, and it's predominant, and it's basically the view that either all knowledge comes from science alone or our best knowledge comes from science and everything else, you know, delivers us belief perhaps. So you have scientism, this theory of knowledge, and that entails for many people, you know, if all of our knowledge comes from what the sciences give us, well, that entails something called materialism. And that's basically the idea that the only things that exist are, you know, the things that we can touch with our hands and sense with all of our senses. So matter is all that exists.
Right.
And from there, you have this impulse. The third thing I would say is something called reductionism. And that's actually really prevalent out there. And that's the idea that, you know, we have anthropology as a science, and we reduce that to biology, and then we reduce our biology to chemistry, and then chemistry we reduce to physics. And once we get to physics, we get to the sort of bottom level of reality. And so we basically are told that we're able to understand everything as long as we understand the little BBs, you know, the atoms at the bottom of the floor of reality.
Wow.
And that reduces out all this beauty and this mystery and this complexity and you know, that's in the world in many ways. So, and in fact, one last thing I'll say, for many, though, you add those three things, scientism, materialism, and reductionism, and they think that somehow science entails atheism. And that would be, I guess, the fourth one. And I can always remember Alex Rosenberg, who wrote a book a couple years ago called The Atheist Guide to Reality. He says, if we're going to be scientistic, then we need to understand that what physics tells us is the truth about reality. And then he says, and that's why I'm so confident about atheism. So there you go, from this theory of knowledge to a view of the world to therefore no God exists. So that's the prevalent and dominant philosophy that undergirds much of the disenchanted way of looking at the world.
Wow, that's a really good explanation, I think, for what's going on. But here's the irony that strikes me as you're describing all of that. On the one hand, for these folks, man is nothing. because there's no creator. There's no moral mind to which we're accountable. Ultimately, they reject Christianity. There's no God. But on the other hand, man is everything. How can I decide what is true? I decide from science what is true. And you know, going down to the reductionism, as you mentioned before, how can man simultaneously be nothing and have no purpose? And yet they are arrogant enough to think man knows everything. How can those things be simultaneously true?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's interesting when you reduce the world and the things that God has made to the level of human appetite. I mean, I do think you lose the world and everything becomes small. And so the only thing that's left is man to become big in it. So I think a lot of that is just the way that, you know, I think there is this natural impulse that God has made us to long to know. And so I think there's this myth, there's this other sort of narrative that has been with us since at least the Enlightenment. It's called the myth of progress, or this optimism that man, you know, through dint of human reason alone, can discover and unlock all the mysteries of life. And if you, you know, and rightly so, we have, you know, learned a lot about the world, and it's amazing how God has made us to learn. But I think if you disconnect that from, you know, the sort of moorings of the biblical worldview, well, it only makes sense that man would elevate themselves. So you hear people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's a great popularizer of science, but he's also, I think, a great purveyor of this disenchanted view of the world. He'll say things like this, you know, you are only stardust. But, you know, I take comfort in the fact that I'm part of this amazing world. And so it does seem a little odd to hold these together, but yet that's kind of what all you can do.
That's what they do.
Given that world.
Yeah, I don't understand him at all. Whenever I watch his videos, I'm like, you are so off base. Brilliant man in some regards, but really off base when you don't understand who is at the center of the universe and it isn't man. So when we're talking about the cosmos and we're looking at the cosmos and we are inculcating into our understanding of the cosmos that there is a creator, that he is good, that he is holy, and we see that the heavens are reflecting his image. How do we explain that to people? How, in other words, as a Christian, how do you look at the cosmos and say, you can see God's image in the cosmos, and here's how we know it's there?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is something I've been learning as I've been studying and writing on these topics, is that I'm more and more convinced that everything that God has created in some way points back to and illuminates the divine in some way. And so part of our job, I think, as Christians, and this is part of our job, is that we would learn to see and delight in the world the way that Jesus does. You know, and if you look at even the Gospels and how Jesus interacts with the world around him and people, you know, it's a God-based world where everything is sacred, everything is gift, and it's infused with meaning and beauty and so on. So I think the first step for us as Christians is actually to kind of recapture that old way of looking at the world, that it is gift. And so, in fact, I'm up in northern Wisconsin right now in a beautiful part of the country. And I was out kayaking on the lake and just sort of talking to God a little bit. And Psalm 27, verse 4 came to mind, where, you know, it's this passage where David said, you know, one thing I seek of the Lord is that I would dwell in the house of the Lord and to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. And, of course, David's talking about the physical temple in Israel. But as I was thinking sort of canonically and biblically, you know, there's the idea that this world that God has created is the cosmic temple. And one day, you know, in the eschaton, God will reside in it face to face, but it is a temple. And so just as I was out there kayaking and trying to really pay attention to the world that God has made, not just to notice the beauty, but as Lewis would put it, to notice the beauty, you know, the source of beauty that we see through it, that I think leads us to God. So part of it's that we need to recapture this mindset that everything is made and sustained by a loving and caring God.
That's great. That's so true. I mean, that's the experience that we all have. It goes back to Romans 1 when it talks about the fact that God is evident in the things that he has made. So man is without excuse. I think that passage actually is very relevant for our own day.
Yeah, and notice what it says. In Romans 1:20, it says that, you know, that we can clearly perceive through that which he has made.
Yes.
And that language, clearly perceive, is kind of interesting. A lot of theologians today are talking about a disenchanted way of perceiving that is actually a form of idolatry, you know, where we fail to see the world the way that it actually is. And so part of our job, I think, as Christians, and Scripture is pretty clear on this, that, you know, everything that God has made, we see him through that which he has made. And so that's part of this recapturing what I think the ancient theologians would call a sacramental view of the world, but that all is gift, all is created, all is from him and through him and to him and things like that.
I love that. Well, and you talk about this in your article in the book when you talk about, as you mentioned before, a return to the older God-bathed and God-infused way of looking at the world is needed. We're going to talk about it more. Paul Gould with us. We'll come back talking about the story of the cosmos. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us. There's been a leftist takeover within conservative Christianity. Ungodly socialist ideas are coming to prominence. Ideas like social justice, critical race theory, and cultural Marxism. And leading figures within mainstream evangelicalism are showing themselves to be untrustworthy as shepherds and guardians of the truth. If you're a Christian who wants to know what to do about this serious shift away from biblical truth, then I invite you to join me at the upcoming Stand Against Marxism conference, taking place October 18th and 19th. In Des Moines, Iowa. Hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project, the Stand Against Marxism conference will inform you about this dangerous infiltration of postmodern thought, connect you with other concerned Christians, and teach you how to defend biblical Christianity in your own church. Register now for the Stand Against Marxism conference, October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa. For more information, you can visit standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com. See you there. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Let me tell you about Gofran and Khalid. They're refugee brothers who were orphaned during the Syrian war, and now they live in a tent in a farmer's field in Lebanon. It's a sad situation. But every other week when Heart for Lebanon's Hope on Wheels educational fun truck shows up, they're usually right on the front row singing worship songs and reciting Bible verses. In the middle of despair, Gofran and Khalid are finding hope in Jesus. But this only happens as you give. $29 a month will help bring Christian education, food, and survival essentials to boys like this and their families. Call 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. For just 98 cents a day, you can help a refugee family of six for an entire year through the great work that Heart for Lebanon does every single day. Please call now, 888-247-5499, 888-247-5499, or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you here and great to have with us Paul Gould. He teaches philosophy and apologetics at Oklahoma Baptist University. He's the founder and president of the Two Tasks Institute and general editor on this book, The Story of the Cosmos, How the Heavens Declare the Glory of God. Now, I had mentioned before we went to the break, Paul, something that you had said in the chapter that you wrote in this book, that a return to the older God bathed, and I love that phrase, and God infused way of looking at the world is needed. And you say the fix is both philosophical and imaginative, but even more so, it's theological. Now, explain that a little bit, because theologically, we know when we're talking about passages like the Psalms and about Romans 1, we understand that there's a theological problem that naturalists will have. But philosophically and imaginatively, what are you talking about there when you say that's part of the fix as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that one of the things that people are becoming increasingly more aware of is the fact that we're more than rational animals. We are rational animals, but we're so much more. We're moral animals. We're imaginative animals. We're narratival animals. In other words, we live our life according to some story. And so as you take that together, the chapter that I wrote in this book, it does talk about these two sort of dominant models of perceiving or imagining our place in the world. And that really matters, because how we perceive and imagine ourselves within this world affects how we act in it. It affects what we see. It affects how we ultimately, the kind of person that we will become. Yeah. And so there's these dominant models. I talk about it as the word is the Neo-Humean model, because it's gifted to us by David Hume, who was an Enlightenment thinker. But it's basically what I said earlier, this idea that, there's no necessary connections between anything. You just have the BBs and arrangements of the BBs in this world. And that's kind of the dominant way of perceiving the world today. And it has materialism and scientism and often atheism within it. But the ancient way of viewing the world, I call it the great tradition. It was actually kind of this blending of the Christian worldview and a kind of Platonism and a kind of Aristotelian view. And the idea there was that the physical world participates in the sacred order, the divine order. That's the Platonic piece. The Aristotelian piece is the idea that there's teleology or purpose or design to the world, and so everything, fits together. And then the Christian piece, of course, is that that there's a harmony, a hierarchy, and a fittingness to the world. And if you add those all together, you begin to see, I think, and imagine yourself as part of an ongoing story, a story that's alive and that understands us. And within that story, God takes up his place in the incarnation, and Jesus comes down and is part of this and so on. And it's just a much richer experience of the world. And the way I kind of say it is, if you think about, a lot of times I'll end up teaching some of the ancient literature of the Greeks and the Romans. And if you read, for example, a Homer or even a Plato or an Aristotle or a Cicero, that world and the ancient experience of the world was much different than the experience of the world today. For the ancients, you never knew if you're going to come face to face with a god or a goddess, or a nymph or a dryad in a tree or a river. And so there's a kind of vulnerability to the world, and that's how they lived. This fear of divine judgment was constant. But if you contrast that with the modern experience of the world, we're trying to buffer ourselves from the world. We live in homes, and we buffer ourselves from the environment as best we can, and we drive around in cars with air conditioning and so on. And of course, we even mediate much of our experience of the world through our screens and our smartphones and things like this. And so we're not imagining ourselves in a world that has the presence of God as part of the fabric of the world. And so what happens is our Christian experience then of the world is very disenchanted and God absent and so on. And so it makes it hard for us to sort of join our minds with our imaginative parts of ourselves. It makes it really more difficult if we're kind of following that the more modern way of experiencing the world around us.
Boy, that's so true. When you were talking about that, I was thinking to myself how bored we are with the space program, for example. I'm saying?
Exactly.
The Concorde. Yeah, they grounded the Concorde. Yeah, that plane that could fly to Europe in just a few hours. And yeah, we went to the moon, but that was before I was born. And now that, the Hubble telescope, it can see, millions of light years or whatever the distance is. There's such an acceptance that, we've already conquered all the amazing stuff. Have we lost the concept of awe to some degree? Because doesn't awe help you in some sense seek God and realize the truth, the truth of Romans 1 that, oh man, look at all this. This is amazing. Who made all of this?
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. I do think we've lost the sense of awe. And I think that, just to give you an example, the other couple months ago, I was speaking at a high school, I think it was spring break, in the hills of Texas, which are very beautiful.
Yes.
And one day, everybody kind of went on a couple different hikes throughout the area. And then after that, somebody was talking to one of the girls who had went on a hike to the top of a vista that was beautiful and asking, well, how was your experience of, the hike? And she's like, oh, it was great. And so, the question was, why was it so great? And the response was, I got 3 bars on my cell phone. And
oh,
I'm like, oh, you missed, you missed it.
And so, oh, man.
And that's one of the, Holly Ordway, who wrote just an excellent chapter on Tolkien and actually the Silmarillion and his view of the cosmos through that. She talks about how, we bring our phones out and we'll have a beautiful scene in nature and we'll end up taking pictures. And then, we're immediately posting it. And so that the good and secondary thing, the capturing of the image becomes the primary thing. And we kind of forget about the world that we've just, taken the picture of because we're curious about how many likes we get. And so part of it is, just how do we live in this world, given our 21st century and the technology that we have? In some ways, if we're not careful, that's further removing us from the beauty and the rawness of the world. And so we lose that sense of awe.
Everything is reduced to a selfie, isn't it? Right before you fall off the cliff. That's the frustrating part. And isn't it ironic? Because I think all of us have at one time or another made the comment, I took these pictures of the Grand Canyon and it just doesn't capture it. The picture just doesn't capture it. I mean, put the phone down and look at what God has created. That's so true. That's so true. But mindset wise, when you're dealing with this generation of selfie obsessed Americans who sometimes just you know, take at face value the naturalists and never really stop and think. How do you get people to think differently? How do you get people to put down the phones and stop the busyness of life and reflect upon the importance of figuring out the purpose of life as God created it? Because that's, you know, that's obviously the ultimate goal, is the salvation of sinners that Jesus came to secure. How do you deal with students, for example, who might be in the place of a naturalist and bring them along to say, hey, you need to consider a greater vision of who God is and his place in the universe and your dependence upon him?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. And so part of, I guess I would say a twofold answer. It begins with us, I think, as Christians, as believers, is that we, like I said earlier, that we would learn to see and delight in the world the way that Jesus does. But then I think the second thing that we need to work on with real intentionality is, once we have, you know, cultivated ourselves in that way, is that we would begin to invite others to see and delight in the world the way Jesus does.
Right.
And so that's going to require intentionality on our part. It's going to require putting down the phone. It's going to be, you know, for us, we're pretty intentional with our kids to get out in nature, just to hike and to put the phones away, or to have, you know, no phone zone.
Good.
One of the things that I've been doing with our kids, they're a little older now, they're in college down to middle school, but we've been asking this for years, is, you know, hey, over the dinner table, is, you know, how did you see the fingerprint of God in your life today? And it's just asking that question, like, you know, for years they'd say things like, oh, I had a good time in gym today, or, you know, kind of silly things. But over time, the desire is, as we ask that question, as it becomes a normal question in our family, in their own hearts and minds, they'll begin to ask that for themselves, you know, daily. Lord, where are you? And so I think it's, we have to realize that there's nothing neutral. Our cell phones aren't neutral. The way that we embody the daily habits of our lives, they shape us in certain ways. And so one of the things, for example, that God has convicted me, so here I am, a philosopher, right? I talk about ideas all the time. And I wrote a book, or, you know, worked on this book on the glory of God through that which he has made. But I kind of live in books, you know, and so I'm like, okay, I think I need to get some hobbies. I've been talking to my wife about them. So I want to take up astronomy. I want to take up bird watching, and I want to learn about rocks. And you know, so something inanimate, something animate, and of course the heavens. And so I think, like, for me, that's a discipline that I'm trying to take steps in, because I want to get back to, okay, I want to get back to, you know, reality in some ways. And so maybe it's just cultivating those which are so subversive in the dominant mode of being in our world today, because of technology.
I think that's a wonderful idea. See, it's because you've been so busy with your kids. Now, as they're getting older, you might have some time for that hobby.
That's true, too.
You know, we're all there.
I don't have hobbies.
Exactly, exactly. And it's kind of funny, because one of the conversations, I have a daughter who's very interested in science, and she's always bringing us fun facts. And it's funny what has emerged as we talk about different fun facts that she'll talk about. And we'll start getting into theological conversations about, why did God design this? Look, it does this, and then it does this, it does this, and this. And we have this line that we say all the time, it's almost as if somebody designed it that way. And that's kind of been the way that we've said to our kids, see, you can see the Creator God everywhere you look, if you're looking for it.
That's right.
It's so important.
And that was one of the essays in the book was by, actually, he's a Vatican astronomer, and he studies meteorites. And I just reread his essay this past week, and I was struck with, you know, he's just looking at rocks, and well, they're from outer space, so that's kind of interesting, but they're rocks. And he said this comment about how getting in touch with, there's a kind of joy of discovery and a joy of becoming more intimate with the physicalness, the world around us, that he finds as a guy that just, you know, is looking at rocks all day long.
Yeah.
That just caused me to think a little bit about my own life, and, you know, getting back to, you know, just staring at things and really seeing them, you know, and seeing them for what they are. So, yeah, that's a good discipline, I think, for all of us to learn.
Absolutely. Well, there's so many good chapters in this book. Like you mentioned, the chapter on the meteorites and the chapters on astronomy and black holes and evidence for the creation of the cosmos. It's really a helpful resource, I think, for every Christian who wants to delve into this for themselves or for their kids. The Story of the Cosmos, Paul Gould with us. Paul, it was great to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Janet. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. God bless you, too. We'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Parenting is such a monumental task. It's wonderful and tiring and all-consuming and a great blessing all at the same time. Yet who among us doesn't have some regrets about the way we have blown it with our kids in some situations? I certainly do. And my next guest says he can also identify with that and has put together a book to help parents learn from their mistakes or the mistakes of others in order to do a better job raising their children. So joining me now is Jonathan McKee. He has over 20 years of youth ministry experience and speaks to parents and leaders worldwide, and we're going to be discussing his book, If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, Seven Vital Changes I'd Make. And it's great to have you here. Jonathan, how are you?
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You say you're the perfect example of an imperfect parent. Why do you say that?
Because I'm honest.
Honest man.
Introduce me to a perfect parent. I'd love to meet one.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, maybe as parents, we might think we're pretty good, at least until we have teenagers. And then we're humbled. We realize we know nothing.
Oh, amen
but,
to that.
Yeah, no, I, my wife and I, we're actually empty nesters now. My kids are 19, 21, and 23. And as a matter of fact, one of them's back for Easter break right now. It's fun. They're boomerang kids. You send them out and they come back. But I tell you, parenting ain't over. That's one thing we've learned. It doesn't end for sure. And we're just like a lot of parents, I think, in our boat at this time now, which is when we have these conversations with them, sometimes we get off the phone, like they call us from the college dorm and we have a conversation. Then my wife and I look at each other and we say, wow, did we do everything right? Did we equip them for these decisions? And I think like a lot of parents, we kind of look back and go, man, I tell you, if I had it to do over again, I would do, you know, fill in the blank. And that's kind of how this book started. It was by talking with so many parents who even in the middle of parenting, it's amazing how much parents adjust and go, wow, I wouldn't do that again. And kind of sometimes even parent their younger kids differently, right? Or
yes.
Their younger kids probably complain about that. They say, well, how come, you know,
I didn't get away with that.
How come she gets to do that,
yep,
right?
Yep.
So that's a lot of where this came from. And that kind of actually opened the doors to the poll I took at a lot of my parenting workshops and to my readers, asked hundreds of parents one question. I said, if you could go back in time and change one parenting practice, what would you do over? And man, the responses were eye-opening.
Absolutely. And I want to dive into that. I'm curious just to ask you, though, what would you say is your biggest do-over?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, it's funny because in the book, obviously, I talked about seven vital changes I'd make. I think the biggest one for me is I think less would be more. I think I would talk less. I think I would react less. My temper. You know, there's times where kids get mad, and sometimes we tell ourselves, we need to teach them this lesson. And sometimes natural consequences would have done good. And I'm, don't get me wrong, I'm very clear in the book. That doesn't mean let your kids do whatever they want.
Right.
By far, not
right.
That at all. But for me, not, you know, so focused on boundaries that it hindered bonding.
Yeah, that's really good. And as you say, you had a lot of different responses when you did the poll. Parents shared a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Were there more on the side of I should have done this more or more on the side of I should have done less of that?
Yeah, you know, it was crazy because in a world where, you know, probably the number one issue parents are dealing with right now is that stupid phone that their kids got in their pocket, you know?
Yes.
I mean, so the reaction that a lot of parents are having every time at my parent workshops, the thing they want to talk about is, what do I do with social media? What do I do with this phone? And the typical reaction tends to be, we need to have more boundaries. We need to tighten down, stop giving our kids phones. We need to not let them on social media. We need to, you know, boundary, rule. And when it came to looking back, the overwhelming regret that parents had more than any other response I received was, I wish I'd spent more time with my kids. I wish we'd had more family dinners. more time in conversation, less time in front of the TV. One mom said, with a do-over, I'd jump in the ocean with them more instead of sitting in the sand watching them play. It was the overwhelming response of, I wish I would have, you know, spent time going up and kissing them goodnight and having those conversations bedside, you know, tucking them in. Less than 2% of parents actually said, I wish I would have had more boundaries.
Oh,
less
wow.
than 2%.
That's telling. That's telling. Well, you know, and I related when you talk about parents who say, but I was so tired. I was doing so much. I had so many kids. I was trying. I think this is a very common refrain with a lot of parents is they say, a lot of my parenting is all I could manage at the time because I was so overloaded and I meant well, but I think I blew it and I'm kicking myself because I should have done this. I should have done this. What about easing the burden on parents of saying nobody's perfect? You can't go back, number one. And number two, you know, sometimes what you did in the moment might not have been perfect, but could you have done better in that moment looking back? You know what I'm saying? Like the hardness that we have on ourselves sometimes can be overdone.
Well, I mean, and God is the architect of new beginnings. I mean, whenever somebody was feeling that kind of burden that came up to Jesus, Jesus constantly was like, you know, hey, let's not worry about your past. Let's talk about your future. And that's the good news for parents is so many of us could burden ourselves with guilt and regret. And it's not too late. I mean, even for empty nesters out there, it's not too late to bond with your kid, even if they're on their own, if they're in a dorm or army barracks or just living on their own somewhere, you know, across the country. It's not too late to restore that relationship. And you still can have an incredible impact. You know, I mean, here I am. I'm 46 years old, three, you know, I've only got one teenager left. I'm almost best friends with my dad. We go out to dinner, you know, once a week, and he lives around the corner, and we spend tons of time. And I don't think I would have ever guessed that when I was in high school, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I liked my dad. He was cool and all. But, I mean, you know, those parent relationships can be lifetime relationships. And for parents, it's so important to not neglect that bonding. And, you know, and boundaries are just as important. But it's amazing how many parents get so caught up in boundaries that it hinders bonding and they don't even concentrate on that.
That's so good. How do you advise parents to handle both of those things in a good way, the bonding and the boundaries?
Yeah, wouldn't it be perfect if there was a you know, perfect recipe for how that balance looks and day to day, you know?
Yeah.
And it's my first chapter, I talk about tipping the scales. One thing I really do is I try to enforce the parents that, you know, especially the parents that, you know, we say, man, we want our kids to learn these values, you know, we want them to learn. And sometimes we think the answer to that is through stricter rules. And again, as good as boundaries are, and man, anybody who reads my book will realize, man, this guy, when it comes to social media, when it comes to all this stuff, I'm actually pretty strict. I'm one of those guys who's like, stop giving your young kids devices. I'm pretty strict when they're young, but then I believe in, you know, loosening up as they get older. But as important as boundaries are, the thing that a lot of parents look back on and regret is that so many values are passed down through conversations.
Yeah.
And when parents are so focused on boundaries and that all they are is that drill sergeant, whatever, what happens is they, you know, if they aren't having those conversations, if our kids don't feel safe to open up to us, then we're going to miss key opportunities to walk through life with them and teach them discernment. Or in other words, when mom or dad doesn't have a relationship with their kids, their kids tend to glean values and behaviors from other sources, and that's frightening.
That's true. That's true. You need to dig in the time. You need to put in the time getting to know your kids. I think maybe some parents fall into the trap of thinking, I know my kid. I know my kid. He's my flesh and blood. You know, I don't need to spend that much time talking to him. He doesn't have much to say to me anyway. But doesn't that grow out of the bonding, the willingness of the child to talk and open up?
It is, and when they feel safe, you know, and again, it's not because we let them do whatever they want, but when we are really being proactive about this, and you know, it's funny, being in youth ministry for over 20 years, you talk with a lot of youth workers, and youth workers sometimes will even ask kids, they'll say, you know, hey, what's your number one complaint about, you know, parents, or if you could tell your parents one thing and you know they'd listen, what would you hear? And I've taken those polls personally. Number one answer I always hear from young people is, listen to me. You know, notice me. And it's funny because parents do complain, hey, my kid, you know, won't talk with me. I wrote a book called Get Your Teenager Talking because parents constantly feel that, hey, my kid has one word answers to every question I ask, you know. But the funny thing is, you know, I can talk with a kid for 5 minutes because I go and I speak at school assemblies, whatever. And I actually play a little game. My game is to, within 5 minutes, to get this kid to find out what it is that this kid wants to talk about and free them up to talk about that thing. And most kids, their friends aren't good listeners. They don't have anybody in their life that listens to them. And if you can find out what it is that your kid wants to talk about and get them to talk about that, man, they will talk your ear off. You'll wish they'd stop talking.
That's Jonathan McKee. If I Had a Parenting Do-Over. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Hi, this is Mike Reagan, author, political commentator, and son of the 40th President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. And I enthusiastically support the life-saving work of Preborn. They work 24/7 in the highest abortion cities in America to care for moms in unplanned pregnancies. Would you go to preborn.org today and help save an innocent baby's life?
Saving a baby's life has never been as important as it is right now. With more and more states legalizing abortion up to 9 months, the Ministry of Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasound sessions in the nation. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save babies? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. All gifts are tax deductible, and when you donate, you'll receive a story and a picture of 5 babies whose lives were spared. To donate, call 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229. That's 855-402-BABY, or there's a banner to click at JanetMefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us. And we are also joined by Jonathan McKee, author and youth culture expert, author of If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, 7 Vital Changes I Would Make. And I think this is just such a great subject for every Christian parent to hear some of this advice that Jonathan is giving to all of us. Another one that you've talked about in the book is not sweating the small stuff, how to let things go. That can be a real difficult one. I think for a lot of parents, I've struggled with that a little bit. What hill do you die on? How do you guide people on that?
Well, it's so hard because, I mean, in the moment as a parent, especially, man, when you parent teenagers, that is, talk about a humbling experience. I mean, that is so difficult because, you know, we can constantly talk with them and no matter what we say, we're wrong, right? And they're going to correct us on it and that. And so it's tough because, you know, sometimes we feel like, okay, there's disrespect or disobedience. And I know that a lot of parents, they looked back at the, you know, the fights over, you know, did you brush your teeth? I had a good friend who, you know, told his daughter, hey, you know, stop throwing your towel on the ground when you're doing the shower. Why don't you hang it up and put it away? And he said, man, I tell you, I tell her that every day. He goes, if I don't go in there and make her do that, he goes, at the end of 12 days, there will be 12 towels in a stack in her bedroom. And he was all upset. And he's like, you know, this is disobedience. This is it. And it was funny. And I literally looked at him. And after, you know, having just gone through parenting and looking and dealing with so many parents with so many of these issues, I looked at him. I said, hey, How's your daughter's attitude most of the time? Well, it's pretty good. What are her grades like? Well, actually, she's getting a 4.0. Does she smoke like pot, like around the house? Is she you know, carrying weapons? I'm just, you know, no, of course, no. I'm like, well, I'll tell you what. The next time she doesn't put the towel away, hand her a box of Tide, tell her to do her own laundry, and let it go.
There you go.
Because you've got a good kid. And the thing is, sometimes we, you know, don't even think about the fact that natural consequences can teach far more than any of our lectures. You know, if your kid, you know, if you say grab a coat and they're like, I don't need a coat, you know, that's one of those battles I would have fought. Where now I look back and go, you know what? Let them freeze for a day. They'll remember their coat the next day without you reminding them, you know?
Right.
And there's things in the book I, you know, go through how some ways, how do you spot this in the moment? How do you let your pride drop and how do you, you know, kind of pause and think through these things? Because a lot of parents had regrets in that area of, man, I should have, you know, they afterwards go, I don't think I should have done that. That was a bad move. I should have let that go.
We all have those moments. I was thinking when you were using that analogy, I have the same theory with lunches and forgetting lunches.
Yeah.
And I have one particular child whose name I will not give who is prone to forgetting lunch. And finally, I said, this is the last time. And I only did it a few times where I brought the lunch over to school. I said, this is the last time it's going to happen. The next time the lunch is forgotten, you will be hungry. And that solved it. But that kind of gets to another point that you bring up in the book, which is gradually decreasing boundaries and gradually increasing freedom. Showing those consequences is also important for kids to learn how to stand on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's you know, I'm actually a big advocate of when they're young, being pretty strict with them. And I you know, I talk about in the book kind of what that looks like day to day, especially in a world, you know, now where young people have technology and stuff.
Right.
I think it's great for you to sit your 12-year-old down and, you know, and when, you know, every single, you know, 8 and 10-year-old out there has already got their phone with social media and everything. And if, you know, if your 11-year-old comes up and says, well, I want to be on Snapchat,
right,
you know, it's good for us, the parents, one, to be aware of what's going on. And if we're aware, for example, that COPPA, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, says you can't be on Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook until you're age 13, it's very easy as a parent to say, sorry, you're not 13. Yeah. You can't be on that.
Okay.
And a lot of parents, one, don't even know that. Two, aren't willing to have that conversation because, sure enough, their kid's saying, well, every one of my friends, and we're talking every one of their friends at church has, you know, Snapchat and is on social media. And that makes it difficult because, you know, your kid's the only 11-year-old, the only 12-year-old who didn't lie about their age to get onto those things. And it's tough, but there's times like that where, as parents, we need to be strict. But I let my kids know, and I didn't do this till my last two kids that I kind of learned the hard way with my oldest. And I basically sat them down and I said, hey, I might seem really strict right now. I said, but I want you to know, my goal is by your senior year of high school that you're going to have no rules. And right now, you might think I'm the strictest dad on the block, but my goal is that senior year, your friends are going to be jealous of what you get to do because I want you to be making your own decisions. And I kept true to my word. And it was interesting because they even forgot as they're 17, 17 and a half, and they'd come and go, Dad, you know, can I go here with my friends? I'm like, I don't know, can you? Well, do you think you should? And it was funny because then they started coming to me for advice.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it because they had permission. And a lot of parents don't have their eyes on the calendar. And I made this mistake with my oldest. And we forget that when they're 18 and they're in a dorm, or, you know, across the country or in an army barracks, chances are they're not going to call us up and say, hey, Dad, everybody else is watching Game of Thrones. Can I watch it?
That's right.
They're going to make that decision by themselves.
Yes,
and the only question we need to ask as parents is, are we equipping them for that day to make that decision?
That's excellent. How do you advise parents to learn how to give freedom in appropriate quantities? This is always something that we're walking the tightrope on. Well, I don't want to give too much freedom, but I don't want to restrict too much. But you're right. I'm with you completely that you need to have rules and boundaries and be stricter when they're younger so they, you know, will learn how to do the right thing. What about how much freedom is too much freedom?
Yeah, well, and it's a great question, and I'll say again, there's no magic recipe. I mean, in the book, I give specific advice of here's what this could look like with your sophomore, with your junior, with your senior, but it's funny, you get five sets of amazing parents on your show, and you ask them all about what are the practices you should do. They're all going to agree on bonding. They're all going to absolutely agree. As a matter of fact, every parenting expert out there says more conversations, but when it comes to boundaries, nobody agrees.
Wow.
Nobody agrees. It's amazing. You get five of the best sets of parents and you ask them all, what time do you make your kids go to bed? One's going to say, we don't have a bedtime. One's going to say 9 o'clock because they need those 9 hours and a quarter recommended by the National Sleep Foundation. Somebody else will be like, I don't know. It depends on their homework load. Everybody's going to be different. And that's the tough thing in parenting. And rather than being that strict rule, you know, one of the recommendations I really make for parents is walking with them through this, because there's times where you're not going to know the answer. Your kid's going to come up and ask about some new app that you've never even heard of before, and can I have that? And rather than, you know, just quickly, no, because apps are bad, you know, or rather than, sure, do whatever you want, sometimes the answer is, I don't know, let's check it out together.
Okay.
And that way you're walking with them through some of these decisions. And it's cool because that whole process of teaching them how to think and teach them how to look and tap into their own values and morals and what the Bible says to make those decisions is the process that hopefully they'll do when they're on their own.
That's so true. When you talk about passing on Christian values to your kids, all Christian parents want their kids to be saved and to follow Jesus and to live lives that please the Lord. That's not something you can control, though. That is from day one, regardless of how much you love that baby who's in your arms, that is an individual human being with his own will and his own walk and all the rest and all the factors that come into play. What about really having an impact on your child for Christ? What would you advise Christian parents to do?
Well, and that's where I really, in the final chapter, tried to talk about what that looks like. It's kind of Deuteronomy 6 in action. It's walking with our kids. And if we want to impress these values, this truth, this biblical truth on our kids, what's it look like? It's actually not through being super strict, and it's not through letting them do whatever they want. It's through walking with them along the road as they get up, as they go to bed at night. Because, I promise you, this world is full of lies.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, last year, the word of the year, according to the Oxford Dictionary, was post-truth. That was the word of the year. And Oxford always looks at our society and goes, what's the word that represents, you know, like a couple years ago, selfie, you know, that represents our society. And this past year, it was post-truth. And their definition basically is, forget the facts. What feels right? And that's really a good representation of what our society is teaching young people right now. What feels good at the moment? It takes a parent who's walking with their kid, talking with them about this stuff all the time, keeping those open conversations in their kids' lives. This takes effort. This takes work. There is no quick fix. There is no app that where you just monitor your kids on this. This is good old-fashioned face-to-face conversations, hanging out with our kids. And that's why I spend that whole chapter just talking about that, because what that looks like today in a world so full of lies, being that beacon of truth, it's our calling as a parent.
It really is. It's such good advice, Jonathan. You've got so much good stuff packed into this book, and advice about dealing with anger and pressing pause and noticing your kids and so many good things that I think are really going to help a lot of parents bond and be able to raise their children in a way that really is successful and in a godly fashion. It's such a good book. It's called If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, 7 Vital Changes I'd Make. Jonathan McKee with us, and so good to talk to you. Thank you, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, you take care. And thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. Always a pleasure to be with you. God bless you, and we'll see you again next time.